Hey, thank you. Share my screen. Okay, hope you can see it now.
Yes.
Sorry, 1 second. Okay, this works great. Yeah, so I of course also completely agree that the main science case is detecting ultra-energy cosmic ray sources for GCOS. But it's also the main science case of OJ Prime, and it's also the main science case of TA10-4 and quite a few more experiments even before that. But at least these two, OJ Prime and TA10-4, will be finished before GCOS. And yeah, you might have a problem with the funding agency saying, okay, we want to detect the ultra-energy cosmic ray sources, and then they will say, but we just gave you a bunch of money to OJ Prime or TA10-4 to do the same thing. So I think it's good to also think a bit further than that and think about the situation, about the positive case. So I'd like to think maybe a bit more optimistically than Michael, and think about the positive case of what we could do if OJ Prime or TA10-4 actually, with more certainty, discovers already a source, a nearby source. And of course, the current status is that we're at the 4 sigma level for both for OJ and TA, with hotspots and detecting different sources. So then stole this screenshot from the presentation of Fred from earlier this morning. So by 2030, even the TA hotspot may be confirmed at the 5 sigma levels, and OJ is one or more source classes of ultra-energy cosmic ray sources may be discovered. So I think it's good to address the question of what can we learn from GCOS and anisotropy measurements if some nearby sources are indeed identified. So I also one quote here from a very recent OJ paper saying that identifying the sources of ultra-energy cosmic rays indeed runs parallel to deducing properties of galactic and extragalactic magnetic fields, and constraints on one of these will enhance our understanding of the other. So that means that if you indeed see nearby sources, then we can use those ultra-energy cosmic ray measurements to constrain extragalactic and galactic magnetic fields. So let me continue. So what do we need for that? Well, we can split them up in both turbulent magnetic fields and uniform magnetic fields. So turbulent magnetic fields basically spread around the cosmic rays around the source position, while uniform magnetic fields shift the source position. And in both cases, if you write down the formulas like that, then you have on the left here the ultra-energy cosmic ray measurements, so the energy, the charge, and the angle away from the source. And on the right, the magnetic field properties, including the magnetic field strength and correlation length in this case. So the most important thing here is the charge of the cosmic rays, which is of course very important for these kind of studies. And if you can do this event-by-event rigidity, this will be really a huge benefit for these kind of studies on extragalactic magnetic fields. So I think this is a very good opportunity for GCOS to step in. And the current status of magnetic fields. So I stole this slide from Michael. So the current status is that for the galactic magnetic fields, you have coherent and random fields of the order of magnitude of a microgauss. We don't know exactly how strong. And we basically don't know the coherence length. This is also several orders of magnitude in between. And even what I would like to add here is that we have galactic magnetic fields that are better known in the disk of the galaxy than in the halo. And for our ultra-energy cosmic rays, the halo is especially important. And we also don't know the extent of this magnetic fields in the halo. So this is, I think, provides a very good opportunity to contribute here from the ultra-energy cosmic ray side. And on the extragalactic magnetic fields, we basically know even less. There's upper limits of 1 nanogauss for extragalactic magnetic fields in voids. But if you're talking about sources that are 3-4 megaparsecs away, we cannot really be certain that we're talking about the voids in between or just in larger structures. So even this upper limit is not really valid for the sources that we're considering here. So really, we don't know much at all about these magnetic fields, means that there is a large opportunity for significant contributions from the ultra energy cosmic ray community, in my opinion, at least. So we did a study in this direction already for the current results of Auger, where we assumed that the starburst galaxies are indeed the sources of ultra energy cosmic rays. And what you get out then is something like this. You get a figure that depends on the local source density and the strength of the magnetic field. If you assume that the local source density is the one of the starburst galaxies, then you get a lower limit on the magnetic fields, just because we mentioned earlier already, we actually see a very isotropic sky, unexpectedly isotropic. So because of this high degree of isotropy gives you this lower limit. But of course, the anisotropy that we do see gives you also an upper limit. So in this case, we also get an upper limit. And this upper limit is not a 5 sigma upper limit, but still for the 90% confidence level reaching, you can get also an upper limit from this ultra energy cosmic ray measurements. And then there's several other papers which are worth looking at as well, that go also in this direction. So to conclude, main science case, detecting ultra energy cosmic rays, but what if this already happened before GCOS, then I think this, especially constraining the magnetic fields, will be very interesting. And there's, I think, a very good potential for GCOS in this direction. So let me stop there.
Thank you very much, Arjen, for this interesting science case. We have time for one question. Someone from Zoom?
Yes, if I'm allowed to, yeah. So now, Arjen, if you were able to make a theta RMS angular deflection or whatever, give a label to the rigidity plot that Michael has shown, what would our rigidities correspond to if somebody would ask you, with all the limitations we have, what angular scale would you assign to those rigidities? I know it's more a guess than anything else, but I still think it's an important part, because showing the plot in rigidity is, of course, the physics, or let's say scientific, really more sound, but for politicians or for the others, we should give it an angular scale.
Yeah, exactly. So there are a lot of subtleties in this, because there is this theta that's given here is again something else than this theta RMS, which is in this formula. But roughly speaking, I'm not really sure how we could basically you measure this, right? So this will give you the angular scale, because what Auger assumes here is that the source is just fixed at the same position. So if there's no shift, which is, perfectly fine with the data we have at the moment. And then what is this theta that is measured here is straight up a measure for the spread around the sources. So that would just be this 16, 15 degrees. But of course, that's for, say, we're looking at energy of 40 EV now, most probably this nitrogen or something like that. And then you can get that
I can try scaling with converted, yeah. But it's worth doing it just to see whether it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So that is also, you need relatively strong magnetic fields. That's the, also to get this this large, for these are really nearby sources, right? So the source distance is in here as well. And we're talking about 3-4 megaparsecs. So you get, of course, these formulas are very simplified. So they assume, one magnetic field structure and of course this should be split up in the galactic magnetic field structure and extragalactics, which changes this. But this is also what we found here. So you need a strong magnetic fields to agree with these kind of relatively large angles that you get, a large shift of this fission, even for nitrogen.
Yeah. Which is actually, a lot of people always said that the magnetic field would be strong. Yeah, it's not that nobody has.
Of course,
the community. Yeah.
No, it's. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry, I think we have to stop here the discussion. Maybe we can continue it tomorrow because this is one of the interesting science cases. And we have to move on to the next talk. So thank you, Arian. The next talk is going to be by Armando Di Matteo about how isotropic can the ultra high energy sky really be.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you see my slides? No, but these are the wrong ones.
Four slides.
Okay. Can you see my slides in full screen?
Yeah. Now it's full screen.
So essentially, the question I'm going to ask is the how isotropic can the high energy cosmic ray sky be? What that did mean? So we know that the propagation length at the highest energies is limited to around 100 megaparsec, and that the universe is not homogeneous on such scales because there are over and under densities. So we should be able to see imprints of the source distribution. Now, there are the magnetic fields which complicate the situation because they distort the picture, but we can minimize their effect by considering the dipole amplitude and the quadrupole amplitude, because the regular diffraction can only change the position of an isotope, it's not their amplitudes, and also the turbulent diffraction mostly have effects to higher order multiples, the lowest order ones, and the effect is relatively small. So in order to attenuate the dipole by 20%, you would need a turbulent diffraction of order of 50 degrees. And in this paper, you can see more realistic estimate by how much the turbulent deflection can attenuate. And the dipole is usually attenuated by a few tens of percent at most, and the quadrupole by at most a factor of a few. So it's not going to be attenuated by orders of magnitude. So we can ask what's the least amount of anisotropy we could expect. So the way we can get a lower bound, but Peter and Tiganiakopenai did in this paper, was to assume that there are no sources in the immediate vicinities, which would possibly give large anisotropies from the sources within 5 megaparsec. Between 5 and 250, we assume that every single galaxy is a cosmic ray source. And at more than 250 megaparsec, where we assume that the cosmic rays are accelerated homogeneously, isotropically in the whole sky. Now, this is not a mathematical theorem that this assumption would give a lower bound, because in principle, it's possible that anisotropies from nearby sources cancel out those sort of faraway sources, but it have to be a coincidence. It's not something you would naturally expect to happen. Then, once you fix a source distribution, you can use several different mass compositions and see which results in less anisotropies. We used two different models for the regular galactic magnetic fields, and we used an upper bound to the turbulent galactic magnetic field. So the results are this. So this is the dipole amplitude, and this is the quadrupole amplitude as a function of the energy threshold for several composition scenarios. And then here there are the lines for the sensitivity, but then they were over the optimistic prediction. You should ignore these dotted lines. But anyway, what you can see is that above 30 eV, we are guaranteed, if our assumptions are correct, to have a dipole amplitude of at least 13%. And indeed, at the last IFRC with the full sky coverage by combining on GNTI, we got 12 minus 4%, which means that if we get 10 times more exposure, and also we eliminate the systematic exposure uncertainty due to the calibration between OJ and PA by using the same kind of detectors in both hemispheres, we would get 11 sigma significance. And for the smaller increase in exposure, we still would get 5 peak significance. And for the quadrupole, in consideration, even though it's significant, we expect it to be smaller. this was about large-scale anisotropy, but in the OZPI joint working group on a double direction, we are running simulation studies about the medium-scale anisotropies, so the searches for catalog correlations. And I'm going to show you the first few results of these studies in the OCHA collaboration meeting next week, and then in public they will be shown at the RECAP conference in Rome in September and the UHCR conference in L'Aquila in October.
Okay. Thank you very much, Armando. We have time for one quick question. Someone from Zoom?
Only if nobody else has a comment.
Yep.
Armando, your lines are so much close to 13% at 30. This is with all the variations you have accounted for. So basically, if somebody had a dipole that is smaller, you would be in real trouble. Is that true?
Yes. It would mean that one of the assumptions we made was wrong, but they were pretty general assumptions. So it would be pretty difficult to find out where the mistake is.
And if I would assume to have fewer sources, isn't then the argument you would in general expect a larger dipole?
Yes, in most cases. In principle, it's possible that you have only two sources which happen to be 180 degrees from each other, so the effect would cancel out. But
you could have some fine tuning, all right. Yeah. But in general, if you had fewer sources, it should be large on the larger end.
Exactly. It's not a mathematical theorem, but in average, it's what you expect.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, sir.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Armando. I think we have to move on to the next talk. The next talk is going to be by Glenys Farrar. She's going to talk about measuring the hair of the ultra-high energy spectrum with GCOS. So please go ahead, Glenys.
Hi, thank you. I wish I could be with you, but I'm actually don't wish it now that I think about it. I'm in the mountains in Wyoming on vacation with my husband. That's by way of excusing my slides. Can you see them okay?
Yeah, it's not full screen.
Oh, okay. I think I can do that. Let's see. If I do play, maybe it'll... Is it full screen now?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks to Michael for prompting me to bring this up. It's stuff that is pretty old, that was actually from 2016 and so, mostly with Mike Sutherland and then some other student collaborators. What we looked at is the structure of the deflections in a particular set of galactic magnetic field models of the arrival directions of cosmic rays. And so I'll show you that. And what's so striking is that it reveals a very stunning structure, which if we could see it would be spectacular and has real interesting serendipity for facilitating other discoveries, as I will mention. Here are the two papers. I didn't get organized well enough to put the citations all in the right places. And I should say there was some early work in this direction, theoretical, by the Bartolozzi group, Molerac, Roulet, and Harari. See if I can advance this. Maybe it doesn't want me to advance it. Okay, well, so what's a caustic? You know what caustics are. This image, all these from the web, gives you the idea of the different types of caustics you can get, depending on what the structure of the thing is that's causing the process. It's of course where you get extreme focusing and defocusing in certain regions. And one of the things that's very striking, this image sort of shows, is you can get it with large scale structures and also with small scale structures. And over here are some pictures from Mike Sutherland and my work on deflections of cosmic rays showing at different rigidities what the I'm trying to get rid of some of my local stuff. As a function of rigidity, this is the magnification. So it's the red regions are where it's a factor of 30 stronger flux from a source in that direction. So let me try to say how you'll see these maps over and over. This is a sky map of the direction the source would be. And the color shows them a log base 10 of the magnification, and red is a factor of 30 magnification, and the blue is at least a factor of 30 demagnification. And the thing that I unfortunately couldn't find the full set of images to show you is the energy rigidity scale over which the magnification structure varies is a very small scale. So between 19.5 and 19.4, it will shift. And what the as you go through the different rigidities, what it will look like is that pattern that you see, let's say in the top right, it'll just sort of move around very much the way it looks when you look at caustics in a swimming pool or something, how that can move with time. Here, we would not be able to see the time variation in our lifetimes, but we would, probably we wouldn't. I mean, we were super lucky and found a source in the right direction. It wouldn't be inconceivable, but it's extraordinarily unlikely. But what's very striking is that they move in rigidity and space on a very, and as you can see, they have a very fine scale. And the general character is rather rigidity dependent. So you see as you go down in rigidity, I hope my slides are legible. The top one is at 19.5 and the bottom is at 18.5. And you see that the large scale global structure changes a lot, but the character of there being intense variations from one region of the sky to the other doesn't. And so you can imagine how much information there is in there let's see if I can move to the next slide. Well, this is just a reminder, grab Mikael and tell him how wonderful it'll be when we actually get this all together, but there will be a next generation superseding JF-12. This is another picture showing, this is from, a 2015 ICRC with several students. It was one of the ones references. That same picture you saw on the right is with the sort of the main GMF model we used. It's the JF-12 model plus a particular realization of the random field. On the left, you see what you see with the JF-12 model. I usually don't show it because it reveals the parts of JF-12 that I am sort of, well, we did what we could, but if anyone who's used it remembers, there are kind of places in the model where there's a transition between two, like it's varying one way and another, and you get these little edges. Well, they show up as you would expect from that image with the light going through the glass. Even if it's a large scale, fairly smooth structure, if there's any transitions, you see it even without small scale fields. That's what's here on the left. And on the right, it's with a more realistic random field model. And so you see the random field is not necessary for there to be this effect. And of course, you would not replicate the identical structure. You would never predict the random field in that detail. This shows a slightly more refined. Again, I apologize for my lack of good slides today. Maybe I can add them before tomorrow. But this is a more refined stepping through rigidity. And one of the things to emphasize is that you see it at all rigidities. In a way, the most exciting, very, very dramatic structure is at fairly high rigidities above 19, but you still see it at lower rigidities. And of course, this is a magnification map. It also shows that certain directions are really much more magnified. And by the way, this model, this image shows you which source directions are highly magnified, not where you see the magnification. That's a totally other set of images. I couldn't find those, unfortunately. Anyway, but one of the things that's interesting is in these high latitude regions where, for example, Virgo and so on are located, you get these big magnifications. And that's quite significant in the overall anisotropies we see. So here's sort of wrapping it up. And I know seeing large tables is unpleasant when you're viewing it, but I wanted to show you this since I didn't have the slides. And in this paper put it on the web in 2017, but I didn't get it into JCAP until 2019, with Mike Sutherland, there's tables and tables of this, and they're actually sort of fun to pore over. But this shows now as a listing, you see the first column is the log of the rigidity. We didn't have perfectly uniform, we didn't have 0.1 steps everywhere, but some places we had 0.2 steps. But look at this one, this is one particular direction. We listed, I think, 12 or 14 different directions. And you'll see it varies. But anyway, what I want to just emphasize is, look at that, the factor, this huge factor, 0.07 demagnification and 0.2 away in log of the rigidity, a magnification, or 0.4 away, a magnification of 6, a factor of 100 change in the magnification in the same direction with these rigidity changes. You can fascinate yourself looking at these tables. But let me just comment that I guess it's obvious that the trouble is the composition and figuring out Z to see the structures. So to me, that's a giant, giant issue, whether you could ever see this, whether one could ever see this, but it would be phenomenal if we could. I stress again, it's present in all rigidity, so it's not like we have to be aiming for the very highest energies. Right, you could see this. If you had really faithful reconstruction of the charge, you don't have to have a phenomenally high energy source to see this. If you could study how it evolves with rigidity, you would get a handle on the character of the inhomogeneities. And this is one of the ones that I think we should keep in mind and perhaps emphasize. And I apologize, I didn't start working on this about 2 hours ago, 3 a.m. here. You may remember that the astrophysicists with Hubble, actually, they'll be even more amazing with JWST. They've discovered a number of remarkable things at very, very high redshift. And I wanted to actually find them and give you some examples. But I think they actually found a pair of stars at redshift 6 or something remarkable because of a serendipitous lensing. I'll try to find that and add it. It's pretty amazing. But so what I want to say is that if there were a source that was emitting particles at the rigidity where it was lensed, we could get a factor of 30 or 100 increase in its flux. You know, when you would pull this out with really high statistics and unfortunately high fidelity in the rigidity. So anyway, that's all I had to say, and I leave this for you to enjoy if you wish while we're chatting.
Okay, thank you very much, Glenys, for this nice talk. So I'm afraid we don't have time for discussion about this because we are already over time. So maybe tomorrow we can ask again these to Glenys if you have questions. Okay, and we can move on to the next talk by Luis Ancordocchi about super heavy dark matter and UV physics. So,
let's see. Can you hear me and see the slides?
Yes.
Okay, so Michael told me whether I can do the new physics part of GCOS. Of course, any detector that we want to build should have some kind of fundamental physics. And Dennis talked about the interactions that we share with colliders at much higher center of mass energy. And so the idea here is to talk about super heavy dark matter and UV physics in the context of GCOS. And I really don't have much new to say about super heavy dark matter. Here are the type of detections of super heavy dark matter. We are here in indirect detection. The idea is that we have particles that they are produced during inflation. Let me try to see if I can put a single page to move the slides. So there are particles that they are produced during inflation, and the inflationary period spread all these particles around the universe. And these particles are metastables and they decay. And we look at the subproducts of these decays, that they could be after fragmentations, photons, cosmic rays, and neutrinos. The dominant for us will be photon, will be a perfect signal. And there are uncertainties in the how these particles hadronize. And then there is an astrophysical factor, which is the dominant, how the dark matter is distributed. I think the uncertainties are on the order of 10%. And so what will Shiko's data tell us about super heavy dark matter? Well, if we don't have, if we have null results, we don't see any photons or cosmic rays, we can set bounds on the lifetime of these particles. This is something that was done in the letter of interest of the snow mass process. And using this non-observation, I can get more technical, but not in 5 minutes. So we can guide model building in the early universe. And with the Ogier collaboration, work led by Olivier, we have some results. And all these results have been collected in the white paper. So if you want to know what Shiko's will do, you just have to go over the white paper, and all the information is there. No? What we need here is detection of photons. So I won't spend my minutes on that because we have a nice talk by Marcus coming. So that will be what probably is new or unique to Shiko's with respect to what's done by Ogier. So what I want to discuss mostly here is the other topic, UV physics. And in UV physics, of course, we have violations of Lorentz invariance. And of course, we learn a lot about that with Ogier. And we can improve what we learn with Shiko's. But this is a new model. And it's a model that came after this process of snow mass. So during the process of snow mass, but after the white paper. And so the idea here is to look at the Hilas plot, but not at this region, which is the region that we always look at, the sources that give us the energy of the maximum energy observing cosmic rays. But what I'm interested here is in the excluded region of the Hilas plot. What I mean by that is the magnetic field is so huge that the energy density will collapse into a black hole, okay? If, remember the Hilas plot is magnetic field versus the distance scale of the acceleration region. And so, of course, we want the distance scale of the acceleration regions to be bigger than the corresponding Schwarzschild radius for that given energy. And of course, nobody pays attention to this because it's well up there and this will bound cosmic ray energies at the level of the Planck mass. But the idea here is to look at what will happen if the fundamental scale of gravity is not actually the Planck mass, but it's below the Planck mass. And this is something that it's typical with quantum field theories that in generally they break at some ultraviolet cutoff where gravity becomes strong. And this most often is when we introduce extra dimensions that we have Kaluza-Klein modes in this compactification radius. And so what we've been developing during the past decade, are some conditions that the theories should have in order to be viable theories that can be completed into an ultraviolet region consistent with quantum gravity. So we look at the low energy that here is referred to the IR, that's the low energy, and those low energy quantum field theories, which ones will be able to reach a quantum description without any problem. So by combining all the, we call this the Swanland conjectures, because the theories which are not able to do that are the theories that belong to the Swanland, and the theories that are able to have a nice completion in the ultraviolet into a quantum field theory are the theories that live in the landscape. So we call this the Swanland conjectures because they delineate the border between the landscape and the swamp. So combining some of these conjectures, very recently, in May, actually, last May, this was Montero, Bafa, and Valenzuela, they derived a solution for the cosmological hierarchy problem. So what is the cosmological hierarchy problem? This is the smallness of the cosmological constant in Planck unit, okay? The energy associated to the cosmological constant is roughly 2.3 MeV. So even though this look like an IR effect, is an UV effect. So what is the solution is to add one compact dimension that has a length in the micron range. And this is what they call, and just give you the name, they name it the dark dimension. So when you talk about, when somebody talk about the dark dimension, is the addition of one extra dimension in order to solve this cosmological hierarchy problem. So for a compact radius, you can write the mass scale of these gravitons proportional to the cosmological constant, and the ultraviolet scale takes this form. And of course, I'm not going to go, the math behind this is not so strong, but it requires time to explain it. And so if lambda, the free parameter, is on the order of 10 to the minus 3, that give you a scale in the micron range, you get an ultraviolet cutoff at 10 to the 10 GeV. So my claim here is that the cutoff that we observe in the spectrum is due to the fact that, sorry, it's going to start ringing my phone. So the cutoff that we observe in the spectrum is due to an effect in the sources, okay? So there is no interactions with the CMB above the photopion production threshold because there is a cutoff in the sources at 10 to the 10, which is roughly at that energy, that will imply that particles that are accelerated at higher energies will be impossible because those regions will collapse into black holes. So there is a third possibility then for the observed spectrum. And so how can, what Chicos will tell us about this UV physics? So first, does the spectrum cutoff features a surf cutoff but without universal cutoff? Meaning, do we have a Peter cycle there as we've been studying? So in this case, there is difference among all the cosmic ray sources. So one would expect the properties on the observed spectrum to be different from those of universal cutoff. Okay, for instance, you can have an asymmetry between the northern and southern Smithier spectrum. So if that's the case, then there is this cannot be done with a universal cutoff at which all the sources cut at M ultraviolet. We can also ask for the question, do the nuclear species scale with Z beyond the ankle as we've been discussing with the Peter cycle, or are all the particles experience the same ultraviolet cutoff? Of course, this will give different answers on the mass composition. So what we need in order to test these two possibilities, meaning a cutoff of the sources due to the energies, the sources running out of energy, and the energy scale with Z, or a cutoff at the sources, because there is a fundamental scale of physics that is telling us or is driving that cutoff. So what we need then is high statistic with sensitivity to baryonic composition. And then we also need to try to disentangle this new idea from the standard CCK cutoff. And so how do we do that? Well, to do that, we look at nearby sources, and nearby sources where the CCK interactions are negligible. And so we can study the individual sources, the individual spectrum of these sources, and see whether they are all the same, meaning they are universal, or again, they have these different properties which inherit from the acceleration environment. At the moment, this is the data that was public like a few months ago, everything is consistent with gamma equal to 5 for a single power law extrapolation on the cutoff of the spectrum, but this is just to show what can be done. Again, what do we need for this? We need high statistic data sample with sensitivity to baryonic composition. So a mass requirement for Chico's design consideration, I think, should be what we everybody has been claiming and discussing, that we need a very high statistic and sensitivity to baryonic composition. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you very much, Luis. This is very interesting. So unfortunately, I don't think we have time to go into more details about this at the moment, but again, we can discuss it tomorrow, and we should. So we have to move on to the next talk by Marco Muzio on source constraints from neutrinos and protons with GCOS.
Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Great. All right. So thanks for having me. I'm Marco Muzio. I'm a postdoc at Penn State. And I'm going to be telling you about some work I've been doing to see how GCOS can constrain the cosmic ray source evolution using neutrino and proton measurements. So for this study, I'm using the cosmic ray source model of Unger-Farana-Khodorkovsky, or UFA, and this is taking into account interactions that cosmic rays have after they've been accelerated but are still in the surrounding source environment, and so they're interacting with photons and gas in that environment. And so for this study, I'm considering a model with two source populations. One is kind of a baseline population that's fitting most of the cosmic ray data, and there I'm fixing the model to its best fit parameters for a given evolution. And then I add in a second component, which is a pure proton population producing protons above 10 eV. And there I'll be uniformly sampling the model parameters to explore the full range of model predictions, and then excluding models that are violating cosmic ray neutrino and gamma ray data. So then the question becomes, to what extent can ultra energy protons and their secondary neutrinos be used to constrain the source evolution if source interactions are significant? So just to begin, here's a quick example for star formation rate evolution. Here I'm only considering cosmogenic neutrinos. So on the x-axis is the EEV neutrino flux at Earth, and on the y-axis is the observed proton fraction above 30 EEV. And so every point here is a model realization of that pure proton component. So the blue points are allowed by the multi-messenger data, and the gray points are already excluded by that data. And what you see is there's this tight correlation between these two observables. So you can imagine if the EEV neutrino flux is measured at measured to be 10 to the minus 10.5 in these units, then the proton fraction has to live between these red dashed lines between 0.1 and 0.3%. And so I can just move that constraint over here onto the right. So that would be the constraint for the star formation rate for this assumed neutrino flux. And I can play this game for a lot of evolutions, different assumed neutrino fluxes, and you get a plot like this. So it's a lot to take in. Let's just focus in on one of these. So assuming the neutrino flux is 10 to the minus 10 in these units, and that's about the ice cube gen 2 or grand or Beacon sensitivity. And again, the proton fraction will have to live between these orange lines if this is the measured neutrino flux. And so what you can see is that GCOS will be able to measure the source evolution of these cosmic ray sources, and how to what extent it can do this depends a bit on how high the resolution of the detector ends up being. So in a more conservative kind of scenario with a lower resolution detector, it will be able to measure the evolution for this power law index up to M equals 4. For a more optimistic detector resolution, it can go up to M equals 6, or can resolve a star formation rate evolution. And then in the case that a background-free measurement is possible, it will actually be able to distinguish GRB and AGN-like source evolutions. Okay, so what happens if we add in source interactions? So the story becomes a little more complicated. This nice correlation we had on the left blows up into this correlation on the right. So there's a wider range of possibilities. But there is still a correlation there, and so you can try to play the same game. And so that's what I've done. So this is the corresponding plot to what I showed previously. And so the range here again is bigger, and you can't make the same kind of measurements, but you will be able to place an upper bound on this power law index M by measuring the 1 eV neutrino flux. And it turns out if you also measure the 10 eV neutrino flux, as I'm showing on the right, again, playing the same game, you'll be able to place a lower bound on M. So GCOS measuring the observed proton fraction and then combining this with measurements of the 1 eV and 10 eV neutrino flux should be able to measure the source evolution of these pure proton sources. So just to summarize, we've estimated that GCOS should be able to measure the observed proton fraction at the level of 0.1% or 0.001% in the background free case. And so we'll be able to measure the source evolution, even in the case that there are significant source interactions. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Marco. I think we have time for one short question, since you were very fast with your talk. Anybody here? Someone on Zoom?
Maybe for Michael, like this, you expect, you accept the argument that we can use our data to constrain the source evolution.
Okay, thank you for your comment, Jörg and Michael. So maybe we can move on to another talk. And thank you, Marco. Yeah. So the next talk is going to be by...
So tomorrow we will have discussion, because there are lots of interesting stuff. And
yes.
Okay, but
this yes,
is tomorrow.
That's the plan. So tomorrow we have the discussion. So yeah, for those of you who want to ask some questions and discuss this more in depth, save it for tomorrow. So we have 2 more talks today, and hopefully you can get it over today and discuss tomorrow.
Okay. So FT starts at what?
This is 4:04, so I think we can we go one more?
One more.
Teresa, are you
just
okay?
Doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe you can go one more by Markus Risse. We'll talk about chasing ultra high energy photons with GCOS.
Marcus, we can't hear you.
Yeah, we just hear the keyboard. We hear a couple of
microphone. Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can hear you. Yes.
Okay. Then I share the screen again.
Yes, please.
Can you see it?
Yes, thanks. Now it's okay.
Okay, fine. Thank you. So thanks for the invitation to say a few words about photons with GCOS. And let me say, even if I take the viewpoint of photons, I'm also a big friend of neutrinos and normal cosmic rays. So I think in the end, we have to go multi-messenger anyway. So photons as primaries at ultra high energy. The first notice is that photons are actually the only gauge bosons that we can access as primary cosmic rays. Photons are neutral, so this allows source pointing, and they are also massless, so we can also search for a special type of source for transients by checking for the time directional correlation. So this alone makes photons as a cornerstone of multi-messenger astronomy. Photons are also produced in proton GZK interactions, so they are messengers of GZK effects. The attenuation length of photons is about 10 megaparsecs, which is not just restricted to the galaxy, but to the more local universe, which is complementary to the features of neutrinos. And as has already been mentioned, photons can also be indicators of physics beyond the standard model. Imagine, for instance, a time directional correlation with distant transients, where you would in standard model physics expect no correlation, then this could be a pretty strong indication of very exciting physics like Lorentz invariance violation or axions or something else. And as has been explained nicely by Lewis, also in top-down scenarios such as super heavy dark matter, we expect a large fraction of photons to be produced. So putting together, photons are possible game changers scientifically. Of course, even more if we finally are to detect them. So this brings me to photon detection by air showers, assuming standard model physics. Well, the photon interaction are described by QED, which is the most precise theory that we have. And this has the big advantage that air showers initiated by photons can be calculated quite precisely. So the hadronic uncertainties, they are not totally removed, but they are at least very much reduced to compared to normal cosmic ray showers. Roughly speaking, the cross-section for pair production Bremsstrahlung is roughly the same order of magnitude as proton air cross-section. So this means for detecting photon air showers, the usual air shower detectors are okay. Now, the first thing is to trigger, and here for photon air showers, you surely need an electromagnetic detector to trigger them. Reconstructing the energy, you also need an electromagnetic detector. And then the task is to separate photons from hadronic normal cosmic ray air showers. This you can do by XMAX, again, an electromagnetic detector. And by muons, actually the merit factor of muons, depending on how well you measure muons, can even be much larger compared to the merit factor of XMAX. So roughly speaking, one can say what is good for composition in terms of separation is surely fine for photons. But keep in mind this statement holds if we have an electromagnetic trigger. If the trigger is more sensitive to muons, then you might miss photon air showers since they have so few muons. Now, the current limitation for photon detection at the highest energies, it is mostly exposure. We simply need more exposure. Going towards lower energies, or more generally speaking, where we have larger statistics and background, the separation becomes an issue. This we can see on this slide, the current status of a search for diffuse photon flux. So we see the integral flux for photons as a function of energy, a very busy plot. Also, smaller energies are interesting in principle. But here we want to look in particular at these two points here, the Auger limits at 10 to 19 and 2 times 10 to 19. The limit at 10 to 19 electron volts already contains photon candidate events. So for improving that, we would need better separation at this point. Going to higher energies, for instance, this one at 2 times 10 to 19, we reach a level where we have no photon candidates. So here we need more exposure to come down. What we see is that the points are already scratching optimistic GZK proton scenarios. And this green band here is the expected photon flux for the Auger composition mix. So a realistic photon flux to be expected. And here we see that this is an order of magnitude difference. And this is where GCOS can come into play. So the detection of cosmogenic photons, even assuming a realistic composition, might possibly be in reach with GCOS. Okay, to conclude, photons are a cornerstone of multi-messenger astronomy. Photons are possible game changers. In terms of detection, what is good for composition is fine for photons. Keep an electromagnetic trigger in mind. And the detection of cosmogenic photons might be in reach with GCOS. and taken together, this might bring us to consider the detection of ultra energy photons as a possibly primary GCOS goal. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Marcus. We have time for a very quick question before we finish the session. So someone on Zoom? Well, if not, I think we can close this session, continue the discussion tomorrow and start with Teresa Bister's talk. And now we move on to the discussion on the fluorescence detector.
Okay. Yeah, I just